Chapter 24. And Rarely Just Illness. At the beginning of James Joyce's wonderful story, The Sisters, 1914, the unnamed young narrator mentions that his old friend and mentor, a priest, is dying. There is no hope for him this time, we're told. Already your reader's radar should be on full alert. A priest with no hope? Not hard to recognize in such a statement a host of possibilities for interpretive play, and indeed those possibilities are realized throughout the story. What's of immediate interest here, though, is how the priest got that way. He's had a stroke, not his first, and it has left him paralyzed. Paralysis is a word that fascinates the young boy, quite apart from its meaning. He yokes it with simony and gnomon in a triad of words to obsess over. For us, however, it's the notion of paralysis and stroke that intrigues. Anyone who has ever had to watch a loved one deteriorate after a massive stroke will no doubt look askance at the very idea of such frustration and misery being in some way intriguing, fascinating, or picturesque, and quite rightly. But as we've seen time and again, what we feel in real life and what we feel in our reading lives can be quite different. In this instance, our interest is not in the deterioration of the old priest, but in what his condition is telling us about him, about the boy, about the story at large, and about Joyce's collection, Dubliners, in which it is the first piece. The boy has witnessed James, the priest, begin the slow decline after earlier strokes, his clothing covered with bits of tobacco and ash, his movement awkward, his speech affected. But it's the paralysis after the recent massive stroke that commands the boy's attention. Within the story, the paralysis shows up in several ways, not least of them a sort of madness that set in at the time the priest was relieved of his parish over some incident involving an acolyte. All references to the event are sidelong and somewhat secretive, with shame a distinct component of James's and his sister's responses. Whether the matter involved sexual impropriety or something to do with the litany, we never learn. Only that James was found in the confessional laughing softly and talking to himself. That he spent his last years a virtual recluse in a back room of his sister's house indicates the degree to which emotional or mental paralysis had already set in before his stroke. From this little story, the condition of paralysis grows into one of Joyce's great themes. Dublin is a city in which the inhabitants are paralyzed by the strictures laid upon them by church, state, and convention. We see it throughout Dubliners. A girl who cannot let go of the railing to board a ship with her lover. Men who know the right thing to do but fail because their bad habits limit their ability to act in their own best interest. A man confined to bed after a drunken fall in a public house restroom. Political activists who fail to act after the death of their great leader, Charles Stuart Parnell, some 10 years earlier. It shows up again and again in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Ulysses, and even in Finnegan's Wake, 1939. Of course, most maladies in most short stories or even novels are not quite so productive of meaning. For Joyce, however, paralysis, physical, moral, social, spiritual, intellectual, political, informs his whole career. Until the 20th century, disease was mysterious. Folks began to comprehend the germ theory of disease in the 19th century, of course, after Louis Pasteur, but until they could do something about it, until the age of inoculation, illness remained frightening and mysterious. People sickened and died, often with no discernible preamble. You went out in the rain, 3 days later you had pneumonia. Ergo, rain and chills caused pneumonia. That still occurs, of course. If you're like me, you were told over and over again as a child to button your coat and put on a hat lest you catch your death of cold. We've never really accepted microbes into our lives. Even knowing how disease is transmitted, we remain largely superstitious. And since illness is so much a part of life, so, too, it is a part of literature. There are certain principles governing the use of disease in works of literature. 1. Not all diseases are created equal. Prior to modern sanitation and enclosed water systems in the 20th century, cholera was nearly as common as, much more aggressive than, and more devastating than tuberculosis, which was generally called consumption. Yet cholera doesn't come close to TB in its frequency of literary occurrence. Why? Image, mostly. Cholera has a bad reputation, and there's almost nothing the best public relations firm in the world could do to improve it. It's ugly. Horrible. Death by cholera is unsightly, painful, smelly, and violent. In that same period of the late 19th century, syphilis and gonorrhea reached near epidemic proportions. Yet, except for Henrik Ibsen and some of the later naturalists, venereal diseases were hardly on the literary map. Syphilis, of course, was, prima facie, evidence of sex beyond the bounds of marriage, of moral corruption. You could only get it, supposedly, by visiting prostitutes, and therefore taboo. In its tertiary stages, of course, it also produced unpleasant results, including loss of control of one's limbs, the sudden spastic motions Kurt Vonnegut writes of in his 1973 Breakfast of Champions, and madness. The only treatment known to the Victorians employed mercury, which turned the gums and saliva black and carried its own hazards. So these two, despite their widespread occurrence, were never A-list diseases. Well then, what makes a prime literary disease? 2. It should be picturesque. What, you don't think illness is picturesque? Consider consumption. Of course, it's awful when a person has a coughing fit that sounds like he's trying to bring up a whole lung, but the sufferer of tuberculosis often acquires a sort of bizarre beauty. The skin becomes almost translucent, the eye sockets dark, so that the sufferer takes on the appearance of a martyr in medieval paintings. 3. It should be mysterious in origin. Again, consumption was a clear winner, at least with the Victorians. The awful disease sometimes swept through whole families, as it would when one member nursed a dying parent or sibling or child, coming into daily contact with contaminated droplets, phlegm, blood for an extended period. The mode of transmission, however, remained murky for most people in that century. Certainly John Keats had no idea that caring for his brother Tom was sealing his own doom, any more than the Brontes knew what hit them. That love and tenderness should be rewarded with a lengthy fatal illness was beyond ironic. By the middle of the 19th century, science discovered that cholera and bad water went together, so it had no mystery points. As for syphilis, well, its origins were entirely too clear. 4. It should have strong symbolic or metaphorical possibilities. If there's a metaphor connected with smallpox, I don't want to know about it. Smallpox was hideous in both the way it presented and the disfigurement it left without really offering any constructive symbolic possibilities. Tuberculosis, on the other hand, was a wasting disease, both in terms of the individual wasting away, growing thinner and thinner, and in terms of the waste of lives that were often barely underway. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, TB joined cancer in dominating the literary imagination regarding illness. Here's a partial list. Ralph Touchett in Henry James' novel The Portrait of a Lady, 1881, and Milly Theale in his later The Wings of the Dove, 1902. Little Eva in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1852. Paul Dombey in Charles Dickens' Dombey and Son, 1848. Mimi in Puccini's opera La Bohème, 1896. Hans Castorp and his fellow patients at the sanatorium in Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, 1924. Michael Fury in Joyce's The Dead. Eugene Gant's father in Thomas Wolfe's Of Time and the River, 1935. And Rupert Birkin in Lawrence's Women in Love. In fact, Lawrence encodes his illness into the physiognomy, personality, and general health of his various alter egos. Not every one of these was labeled tubercular. Some were delicate, fragile, sensitive, wasting away. Others were said to have a lung or suffer from lung disease, or were merely identified as having a persistent cough or periods of low energy. A mere symptom or two would suffice for the contemporary audience to whom the symptoms were all too familiar. So many characters contracted tuberculosis in part because so many writers either suffered from it themselves or watched friends, colleagues, and loved ones deteriorate in its grasp. In addition to Keats and the Brontes, Robert Louis Stevenson, Catherine Mansfield, Lawrence, Frederick Chopin, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Franz Kafka, and Percy Bysshe Shelley form a fair beginning toward a who's who of artistic consumptives. In her study, Illness as a Metaphor, 1977, Susan Sontag brilliantly discusses the reasons for the disease's popularity as a subject and the metaphorical uses to which it was put. For now, we're less interested in all the implications she identifies and more interested in recognizing that when a writer employs TB directly or indirectly, he's making a statement about the victim of the disease. His choice, while no doubt carrying a strong element of verisimilitude, also very likely houses symbolic or metaphorical intentions. This fourth consideration, the metaphorical possibilities a disease offers, generally overrides all others. A sufficiently compelling metaphor can induce an author to bring an otherwise objectionable illness into a work. A good example would be plague. As an instance of individual suffering, bubonic plague is no bonus, but in terms of widespread societal devastation, it's a champion. In two works written a mere 2,500 years apart, plague successfully takes center stage. In Oedipus Rex, Sophocles has Thebes hit by various plagues, withered crops, stillborn children, the works. But here, as in general use, plague carries with it the implication of bubonic. It comes to mean what we think of as plague, in fact, because it can lay waste to whole cities in short order, because it sweeps through populations as a visitation of divine wrath. And of course, divine wrath is the order of the day at the beginning of Sophocles' play. 2.5 millennia later, Albert Camus not only uses plague, he calls his novel The Plague, 1947. Again, he is not interested so much in the individual sufferer as he is in the communal aspect and the philosophical possibilities. In examining how a person confronts the wholesale devastation wrought by disease, Camus can set his existentialist philosophy into motion in a fictional setting. The isolation and uncertainty caused by the disease, the absurdly random nature of infection, the despair felt by a doctor in the face of an unstoppable epidemic, the desire to act even while recognizing the pointlessness of action. Now, neither Camus's nor Sophocles' use is particularly subtle or hard to get, but in their overt way, they teach us how other writers may use illness when it is less central. When Henry James has had enough of Daisy Miller and decides to kill her off, he gives her Roman fever, or what we would now call malaria. If you read that beautiful little novella and neither of these names suggests anything to you, you really need to pay more attention. Malaria works great, metaphorically. It translates as bad air. Daisy has suffered from figurative bad air, malicious gossip and hostile public opinion, throughout her stay in Rome. As the name implies, it was formerly thought that the illness was contracted from harmful vapors in hot, moist night air. No one suspected that the problem might lie with those darned mosquitoes that were biting them on those hot, moist nights. So the notion of poisonous vapors would work nicely. Still, the older name used by James, Roman fever, is even better. Daisy does indeed suffer from Roman fever, from the overheated state that makes her frantic to join the elite. "We're dying to be exclusive," she says early on, while at the same time causing the disapproval of the Europeanized Americans who reside permanently in Rome at every turn, when she makes her fatal midnight trip to the Colosseum and sees the object of, if not her affections, then at least her interests, Winterbourne. He ignores her, prompting her to say, "He cuts me dead." And the next thing we know, she is dead. Does the manner of her death matter? Of course. Roman fever perfectly captures what happens to Daisy, this fresh young thing from the wilds of Schenectady who is destroyed by the clash between her own vitality and the rotten atmosphere of this oldest of old world cities. James is a literary realist, hardly the most flamboyantly symbolic of writers, But when he can kill off a character in a highly lifelike way while employing an apt metaphor for her demise, he doesn't hesitate. Another great 19th century realist who sees the figurative value of illness is Henrik Ibsen. In his breakthrough play, A Doll's House, 1879, he includes a neighbor to the Helmer family, Dr. Rank, who is dying of tuberculosis of the spine. Dr. Rank's illness is uncommon only in terms of its location in the body, although the respiratory system is the one we always think of. Here's the interesting part. Rank says he inherited the disease from his father's dissolute living. Aha! Now, instead of being a mere ailment, his condition becomes an indictment of parental misdeeds, a strong thematic statement in its own right, and as we latter-day cynics can recognize, a coded reference to an entirely different pair of letters. Not TB, but VD. As I suggested earlier, syphilis and its various brethren were off-limits for most of the 19th century, so any references needed to be in code, as here. How many people suffer from consumption because their parents led immoral lives? Some, certainly, but inherited syphilis is much more likely. In fact, emboldened by his experiment here, Ibsen returned to the notion several years later in Ghosts, 1881, in which he has a young man losing his mind as the result of inherited tertiary syphilis. Intergenerational tensions, responsibilities, and misdeeds are some of Ibsen's abiding themes, so it's not surprising that such an ailment would resonate with him. Naturally, what gets encoded in a literary disease is largely up to the writer and the reader. When, in the course of Justine, the first novel of Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet, the narrator's lover, Melissa, succumbs to tuberculosis, he means something very different from what Ibsen means. Melissa, the dancer slash escort slash prostitute, is a victim of life. Poverty, neglect, abuse, exploitation have all combined to grind her down, and the grinding nature of her illness, and of Darley's, the narrator's, inability to save her or even to recognize his responsibilities to her, stands as the physical expression of the way life and men have quite literally used her up. Moreover, her own acceptance of the disease, of the inevitability of her mortality and suffering, mirrors her self-sacrificing nature. Perhaps it is best for everyone else, Darley especially, if she dies. What's best for her never seems to enter her mind. In the third novel of the series, Mount Olive, Leila Hosnani contracts smallpox, which she takes as a sign of divine judgment against her vanity and her marital lapse. Durrell, however, sees it otherwise, as symptomatic of the ravages that time and living take on us all. In each case, of course, we're free to draw our own conclusions. What about AIDS? Every age has its special disease. The Romantics and Victorians had consumption. We have AIDS. For a while in the middle of the 20th century, it looked like polio would be the disease of the century. Everyone knew people who died, or wound up on crutches, or lived in iron lungs because of that terrible and terrifying disease. Although I was born the year Dr. Jonas Salk made his blessed discovery of a vaccine, I can remember parents during my youth who still wouldn't let their children go into a public swimming pool. Even when conquered, polio had a powerful grip on the imaginations of my parents' generation. For some reason, though, that imagination did not become literary. Polio rarely shows up in novels of the period. Now, AIDS, on the other hand, has been an epidemic that does occupy the writers of its time. Why? Let's run the list. Picturesque? Certainly not. But it shares that terrible, dramatic, wasting quality of consumption. Mysterious? It was when it showed up. And even now, this virus that can mutate in infinite ways to thwart nearly any treatment eludes our efforts to corral it. Symbolic? Most definitely. AIDS is the motherlode of symbol and metaphor. Its tendency to lie dormant for so long, then make an appearance. Its ability, because of that dormant period, to turn every victim into an unknowing carrier. Its virtual 100% mortality rates over the first decade or so of its history. All these things offer strong symbolic possibilities. The way it has visited itself disproportionately on young people hit the gay community so hard, devastated so many people in the developing world, been a scourge in artistic circles, the tragedy and despair, but also the courage and resilience and compassion, or their lack, have provided metaphor, theme, and symbol as well as plot and situation for our writers. Because of the demographic distribution of its infection history, AIDS adds another property to its literary usage, the political angle. Nearly everybody who wants to can find something in HIV/AIDS that somehow works into their political view. Social and religious conservatives almost immediately saw the element of divine retribution, while AIDS activists saw the slow response of government as evidence of official hostility to ethnic and sexual constituencies hardest hit by the disease. That's a lot of freight for a disease which is really just about transmission, incubation, and duration, which is what all diseases have always been about. Given the highly charged nature of the public experience, we would expect to see AIDS show up in places occupied by other ailments in earlier times. Michael Cunningham's novel, The Hours, 1998, is a reworking of Virginia Woolf's modern classic, Mrs. Dalloway, in which a shell-shocked veteran of the Great War disintegrates and commits suicide. In the aftermath of that terrible war, shell shock was a hot-button medical item. Did it exist? Were these men simply malingerers? Were they predisposed to psychological unfitness? Could they be cured? What had they seen that caused them but not others to succumb? With each modern war, the term has changed, from shell shock to battle fatigue in World War II and Korea to post-traumatic stress disorder in Vietnam. And each time the illness has had its believers and its detractors. In a bizarre twist, the Gulf War syndrome, which seemed to be physiological in nature, was dismissed by authorities as simply a modern version of shell shock. These would be the same authorities, of course, who in that earlier age would have denied that shell shock existed. Cunningham clearly can't use shell shock and is even too far out of the Vietnam era for PTSD to have much resonance. Besides, he's writing about the contemporary urban experience, as Woolf was doing earlier in the century. And part of that experience for him is the gay and lesbian community, and part of that experience is HIV/AIDS. His suicide, therefore, is a patient with very advanced AIDS. Other than the illness that occasions them, the two deaths resemble each other greatly. We recognize in them a personal calamity that is particular to its time, but that has the universality of great suffering and despair and courage, of a victim seeking to wrest control over his own life away from the condition that has controlled him. It's a situation, Cunningham reminds us, that differs from age to age only in the specific details, not in the humanity those details reveal. That's what happens when works get re-envisioned. We learn something about the age that produced the original, as well as about our own. Often, though, the most effective illness is the one the writer makes up. Fever, the non-Roman sort, worked like a charm in times past. The character merely contracted fever, took to her bed, and died in short or long order, as the plot demanded, and there you were. The fever could represent the randomness of fate, the harshness of life, the unknowability of the mind of God, the playwright's lack of imagination, any of a wide array of possibilities. Dickens kills off all sorts of characters with fevers that don't get identified. Of course, he had so many characters that he needed to dispatch some of them periodically just for housekeeping purposes. Poor little Paul Dombey succumbs with the sole purpose of breaking his father's heart. Little Nell hovers between life and death for an unbearable real-time month as readers of the original serialized version waited for the next installment to be issued and reveal her fate. Edgar Allan Poe, who in real life saw plenty of tuberculosis, gives us a mystery disease in The Mask of the Red Death. It may be an encoding of TB or of some other malady, but chiefly it is what no real disease can ever be, exactly what the author wants it to be. Real illnesses come with baggage, which can be useful or at least overcome in a novel. A made-up illness, though, can say whatever its maker wants it to say. It's too bad modern writers lost the generic fever and the mystery malady when modern medicine got so it could identify virtually any microbe and thereby diagnose virtually any disease. This strikes me as a case where the cure is definitely worse than the disease, at least for literature. Chapter 25. Don't read with your eyes. Remember the 12th night party in Joyce's story, The Dead, that we looked at earlier? To a child of late 20th century America, or early 21st for that matter, the meal is no big deal, except for the goose. Not that many households in this country roast a goose for the holiday, or any holiday. But the rest looks pretty ordinary to us. A vase with stalks of celery, American apples and oranges on the sideboard, flowery potatoes, nothing very remarkable. Unless you live, as do the old ladies who provide the meal, in pre-electrification Dublin, where it happens to be the 6th of January. So if you're going to understand the ladies and the meal and the story, you have to read through eyes that are not your own. Eyes that, while not those of Aunts Kate and Julia, can take in the meaning of the meal they have provided. And those eyes did not grow up watching Animaniacs. The ants have provided a meal beyond their limited means, in which they feed exotic and expensive produce to a substantial number of guests. Celery does not grow in Ireland in January, and the fruit is from America, and therefore quite expensive. They have gone to considerable expense on Epiphany, the second most important day of the Christmas season, the day the Christ child was revealed to the wise men. In addition to its religious significance, the evening is also the old lady's one big extravagance of the year, the party by which they cling to a fading gentility and memories of greater comfort as members of the middle class. We cannot understand their anxiety over the success of this gathering unless we see how important it is in their lives. Or take this situation. James Baldwin's wonderful short story, Sonny's Blues, deals with a rather uptight math teacher in Harlem in the 1950s, whose brother serves time in prison for heroin possession. At the end of the story, there's a scene we looked at in an earlier chapter, where the brother, Sonny, has returned to playing in a club, and the math teacher, our narrator, goes to hear him for the first time ever. There's been a lot of tension throughout the story since the two don't comprehend each other, and the math teacher really can't fathom the troubles that drive Sonny and his music and his drug problem. Nor does he understand jazz. The only jazz name he can come up with is Louis Armstrong, proving to Sonny that he's hopelessly square. As the brother sits listening to Sonny with the jazz combo, however, he begins to hear in this beautiful, troubled music the depths of feeling and suffering and joy that lie behind it. So he sends an offering, a scotch and milk, that indicates understanding and brotherhood. Sonny sips, sets the drink back on the piano, and acknowledges the gift, which shimmers like the very cup of trembling in the closing words of the story. It's deep and emotional and biblical, with a resonance that very few stories ever achieve, about as close to perfection as we're likely to encounter. Now here's where the business of interpretation gets interesting. At my school, there are sociology/social work classes on substance abuse. And two or three times I've had a recent student in said substance abuse classes show up at discussions of Sonny's Blues very earnestly saying something like, "You should never give alcohol to a recovering addict." Perfectly true, I'm sure. In this context, though, not helpful. This story was published in 1957, using the best information Baldwin had at that time, and it is meant as a study of relations between brothers, not as a treatise on addiction. It's about redemption, not recovery. If you read it as the latter, that is, if you don't adjust your eyes and mind to transport you from contemporary reality to Baldwin's 1957, whatever the ending has to offer will be pretty well lost on you. We all have our own blind spots, and that's normal. We expect a certain amount of verisimilitude, of faithfulness to the world we know, in what we watch and what we read. On the other hand, A too rigid insistence on the fictive world corresponding on all points to the world we know can be terribly limiting, not only to our enjoyment, but to our understanding of literary works. So how much is too much? What can we reasonably demand of our reading? That's up to you. But I'll tell you what I think, and what I try to do. It seems to me that if we want to get the most out of our reading, as far as is reasonable, we have to try to take the works as they were intended to be taken. The formula I generally offer is this: don't read with your eyes. What I really mean is, don't read only from your own fixed position in the year of our Lord 2000 and some. Instead, try to find a reading perspective that allows for sympathy with the historical moment of the story, that understands the text as having been written against its own social, historical, cultural, and personal background. There are dangers in this, and I'll return to them. I also need to acknowledge here that there is a different model of professional reading, deconstruction, that pushes skepticism and doubt to its extreme, questioning nearly everything in the story or poem at hand, to deconstruct the work and show how the author is not really in charge of his materials. The goal of these deconstructive readings is to demonstrate how the work is controlled and reduced by the values and prejudices of its own time. As you will have discerned, this is an approach with which I have limited sympathy. At the end of the day, I prefer to like the works I analyze, but that's another story. Let's return for a moment to Baldwin's math teacher and Sonny's addiction. The comment about giving alcohol to an addict betrays a certain mindset about social problems, as well as a unique history of artistic and popular culture experiences on the part of the reader that are at odds with the story's own goals. Sonny's Blues is about redemption, but not the one students have been conditioned to expect. So much of our popular culture, daytime talk shows, made-for-television movies, magazine articles, leads us to think in terms of identifying a problem, such as addiction, and seeking a simple, direct solution. In its place, such thinking makes perfect sense. On the other hand, Baldwin is only slightly interested in Sonny's addiction in and of itself. What he really cares about is the brother's emotional turmoil. Everything in the story points to this interest. The point of view, the brothers, the depth of detail about the brother's life relative to Sonny's, the direct access to the brother's thoughts, all remind us this is about the narrator and not the jazz man. Most tellingly, it is the brother who is removed from his world, taken out of his comfort zone, when he follows Sonny to meet with other musicians and then to hear Sonny play. If you want to put pressure on a character to cause him to change or crumble, take him away from home, make him inhabit an alien world. For the middle-class math teacher, the world of jazz might as well be Neptune. Here's why this business of the reader's perspective matters. This story falls into that very large category that I call last chance for change stories. Not a terribly scientific name, I'll grant, but that's what they are. Here's how they work. The character, sufficiently old to have experienced a number of opportunities to grow, to reform, to get it right, but of course he never has, is presented with one more chance, one last opportunity to educate himself in this most important area, and it varies with the story, where up to now he has remained stunted. The reason he's older is just the opposite of why the quester is typically younger. His possibilities for growth are limited, and time is running out. In other words, there is a time imperative, a sort of urgency as the sands run out. And then the situation in which he finds himself needs to be compelling. Our guy? He's never understood or sympathized with his brother, even to the point of not visiting him in prison. When the narrator's daughter dies and Sonny writes a caring letter of sympathy, he makes the narrator, I'm sorry he doesn't have a name, feel even greater guilt. Now that Sonny is out of prison and not using heroin, the narrator has a chance to get to know his younger, troubled brother as he never has before. If he can't do that this time, he never will. And this leads us to the point of the last chance for change story, which is always the same. Can this person be saved? This is the question Baldwin is asking in the story, but he's not asking it about Sonny. In fact, such is the heartlessness of authors, for the question to really matter to us in terms of the narrator, Sonny's own future must be very cloudy. Whether he can do the one thing in the world he's good at and not be drawn back into the addiction that is rife within the jazz community, we cannot know. Our doubts on his behalf add to the urgency of the narrator's growth. Anyone can love and understand a reformed junkie, but one who may not be reformed, who admits the perils are still there for him, offers real difficulties. Now, if we read the story through the filter of daytime talk shows and social work classes, we not only miss the focus of the story, we misunderstand it at its most basic level. Sonny's trouble is interesting, of course, but it's merely the hook to draw us in. The real issues the story raises all concern the narrator slash brother. If we see it as Sonny's story, the resolution will be profoundly dissatisfying. If we understand it as the brothers, it works beautifully. And this is a fairly recent story. How much harder to understand the mindset behind, say, Moby Dick, The Last of the Mohicans, The Iliad, all that violence, a diet that is almost purely carnivorous, blood sacrifices, looting, multiple gods, concubines? Those readers who have been raised in a monotheistic culture, which is all of us, whatever our religious persuasion or lack thereof, who live within the Western tradition, might have a little trouble with the piety of the Greeks, whose chief implement of religious practice is the carving knife. Indeed, the very setup of the epic, in which Achilles throws a fit and withdraws from the war because his sex slave has been taken from him, does not engage our sympathies as it would have those of the ancient Greek audience. For that matter, his redemption, in which he proves he's back on track by slaughtering every Trojan in sight, strikes us as distinctly barbaric. So what can this great work, and its spirituality, sexual politics, code of machismo, and overwrought violence teach us? Plenty, if we're willing to read with the eyes of a Greek. A really, really old Greek. Achilles destroys the thing he holds most dear, his lifelong friend Patroclus, and dooms himself to an early death by allowing excessive pride to overrule his judgment. Even great men must learn to bend. Anger is unbecoming. One day our destiny will come for us, and even the gods can't stop it. There are lots of useful lessons in the Iliad, but while it may at times read like an episode of the Jerry Springer Show, we'll miss most of them if we read it through the lens of our own popular culture. Now, about that danger I mentioned earlier. Too much acceptance of the author's viewpoint can lead to difficulties. Do we have to accept the values of a 3,000-year-old blood culture as depicted in the Homeric epics? Absolutely not. I think we should frown on the wanton destruction of societies, on the enslavement of conquered peoples, on keeping concubines, on wholesale slaughter. At the same time, though, we need to understand that the Mycenaean Greeks did not. So if we would understand the Iliad, and it is worth understanding, we have to accept those values for those characters. Must we accept the novel that is full of racial hatred, that vilifies persons of African or Asian or Jewish ancestry? Of course not. Is The Merchant of Venice anti-Semitic? Probably. More or less so than its historical moment? Much less, I should think. Shylock, while hardly a glowing picture of the Jew, is at least given reasons for being as he is invested with a kind of humanity that many nonfiction tracts of the Elizabethan period do not credit Jews with having. Shakespeare does not blame him for the crucifixion, nor does he recommend burning Jews at the stake, as was happening in the century of the play's composition in other parts of Europe. So accept the play or reject it. Do as you see fit. What I would suggest is that we see Shylock's villainy in the context of the difficult and complex situation Shakespeare creates for him. See if he makes sense as an individual, and not merely as a type or representative of a hated group. See if the play works independently of whatever bigotry might lie behind it, or if it requires that bigotry to function as art. For me, If it must rely on hatred in order to function, it has to go. I don't see merchant working only or even primarily as a product of bigotry, and I will go on reading it, although there are many works by Shakespeare that I like better and return to more regularly. Each reader or viewer must decide this one for himself. The one thing I find unacceptable is to reject it or any work sight unseen. Let's take briefly a more recent and more troubling example. The Cantos of Ezra Pound have some marvelous passages, but they also contain some very ugly views of Jewish culture and Jewish people. More to the point, they are the product of a man who was capable of being much more anti-Semitic than he is in the poems, as he proved in his wartime broadcasts on Italian radio. I sort of weaseled my way around the issue with Shakespeare, claiming that he was somewhat less bigoted than his time. I can make no such claim for Pound. Moreover, that he made such statements at precisely the time that millions of Jews were being put to death by the Nazis only compounds our sense of outrage toward him. Nor can we write it off as insanity, which is what the defense counsel did at his trial for treason. He was charged with broadcasting for the enemy. So what about the poetry? Well, you decide. I know Jewish readers who still read Pound and claim to gain something from the experience. Others who refuse to have anything to do with him, and still others who read him but rant against him all the while. Nor does one have to be Jewish. I do still read Pound. Some. I find much that is astonishing, beautiful, haunting, powerful. Very much worthwhile. I also find, with some regularity, myself asking, how could someone so talented be so blind, so arrogant, so bigoted? The answer is, I don't know. The more time I spend with him, the more I'm astonished by his capacity for folly. It's unfortunate that genius was harnessed to someone who may not have worn it well. I find the Cantos, for all its brilliance, a very flawed masterpiece. Flawed for reasons other than the anti-Semitism, but certainly more flawed because of it. It remains one of the half dozen or so most important works in my field of specialization, however, so I can't turn my back on it even if I want to. I've been telling you earlier in this chapter that you generally want to adopt the worldview the work requests of its audience. Sometimes, though, as in the case of Pound and his Cantos, the work asks too much. Now here is where I envy you. If you are a professor, you have to deal with some pretty unsavory characters and some questionable works. If you only want to read like one, you can walk away whenever you want to. Chapter 26. Is he serious? And other ironies. Now hear this. Irony trumps everything. Consider roads. Journey, quest, self-knowledge. But what if the road doesn't lead anywhere, or rather, if the traveler chooses not to take the road? We know that roads, and oceans and rivers and paths, exist in literature only so that someone can travel. Chaucer says so, as do John Bunyan, Mark Twain, Herman Melville, Robert Frost, Jack Kerouac, Tom Robbins, Easy Rider, Thelma and Louise. If you show us a thoroughfare, you better put your hero on it. But then there's Samuel Beckett. Known as the poet of stasis, he puts one of his heroes literally in an ash can. The great actress Billie Whitelaw, who was in virtually every Beckett play that called for a woman, said his work repeatedly put her in the hospital, sometimes by demanding too much strenuous activity, but just as often by not letting her move at all. In his masterpiece, Waiting for Godot, he creates two tramps, Vladimir and Estragon, and plants them beside a road they never take. Every day they return to the same spot, hoping the unseen Godot will show up, but he never does. They never take the road, and the road never brings anything interesting their way. In some places, writing something like that will get you a 15-yard penalty for improper use of a symbol. Of course, we catch on pretty fast, and soon understand that the road exists for Dee Dee and Go-Go to take, and that their inability to do so indicates a colossal failure to engage life. Without our ingrained expectations about roads, however, none of this works. Our hapless duo become nothing more than two guys stranded in desolate country. But they're not merely in desolate country, but in desolate country beside an avenue of escape they fail to take. And that makes all the difference. Irony? Yes, on a variety of levels. First, the entire play exists in what the late literary theorist Northrop Frye calls the ironic mode. That is, we watch characters who possess a lower degree of autonomy, self-determination, or free will than ourselves. Whereas normally in literary works we watch characters who are our equals or even superiors, in an ironic work, we watch characters struggle futilely with forces we might be able to overcome. Second, the specific situation of the road offers another level of irony. Here are two men, Dee Dee and Gogo, who wish to find possibilities for change or improvement, yet they can only understand the road they wait beside passively, in terms of what it brings to them. We in the audience can see the implication that eludes them. This is where our expectations concerning roads enter the equation, so much so that we may want to scream at them to walk up the road to a new life. But of course they never do. Or take rain. Of course, we already know that it has nearly limitless cultural associations, but even those won't cover the literary possibilities once irony kicks in. If you read a scene in which new life was coming into being, the rain outside would almost inevitably lead you, based on your previous reading, to a process of association in which you thought or felt, since this really works as much at the visceral as at the intellectual level, rain, life, birth, promise, restoration, fertility, continuity. What, you don't always run that cycle when rain and new life are on the table? If you begin to read like an English professor, you will. But then there's Hemingway. At the end of A Farewell to Arms, his hero, Frederick Henry, having just experienced the death of his lover, Catherine Barclay, and her baby during childbirth, distraught, walks out into the rain. None of those expectations we just listed are going to prevail. In fact, quite the opposite. It might help to know Hemingway's background in World War I, during which the novel is set, or his earlier life experiences, or his psychology and worldview, or the difficulty of writing this passage. He wrote the last page 26 times, he said, in order to make sense of this scene. Most of all, we need to know that it's ironic. Like most of his generation, Hemingway learned irony early, then met it firsthand in the war as he watched youth meet death on a daily basis. His book is ironic from its first words, literally. His title is taken from a 16th century poem by George Peele, A Farewell, about soldiers rallying enthusiastically to the call to war, the first two words of which are, "To arms!" By conjoining these two in one seamless phrase, Hemingway makes a title as nearly opposite Peele's rousing meaning as it's possible to get. That ironic stance pervades the novel right up to the end, where mother and child, rather than existing for each other, as experience has taught us to expect, slay each other, the infant strangled by the umbilical cord, the mother dead after a series of hemorrhages. Frederick Henry walks out into rain in a season that is still winter, but comes on the heels of a false spring. There's nothing cleansing or rejuvenating about the whole thing. That's irony. Take our expectations and upend them. Make them work against us. You can pretty much do this with anything. Spring comes and the wasteland doesn't even notice. Your heroine is murdered at dinner with the villain during a toast in her honor, no less. The Christ figure causes the destruction of others while he survives very nicely. Your character crashes his car into a billboard but is unhurt because his seatbelt functions as designed. Then, before he can get it off, the billboard teeters, topples, and crushes him. Its message? Seatbelts save lives. Is the billboard the same as those other instances of irony? Sure, why not? It's a sign that's used in a way other than the intended one, So are the others. What is a sign? It's something that signifies a message. The thing that's doing the signifying, call it the signifier, that's stable. The message, on the other hand, the thing being signified, and we'll call that the signified, that's up for grabs. The signifier, in other words, while being fairly stable itself, doesn't have to be used in the planned way. Its meaning can be deflected from the expected meaning. Here's an instance. G.K. Chesterton, a mystery writer and contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle, has a story, The Arrow of Heaven, 1926, in which a man is killed by an arrow. Of the cause of death, there is never a flicker of doubt. That's too bad, since it sets up an insoluble problem. No one could have shot him but God. The victim is in a high tower with higher windows, so there is no way for a straight shot except from heaven. Father Brown, Chesterton's little hero-slash-detective-slash-priest, studies the matter a while, listening to all the stories, including one intended to misdirect him, about how those Indian swamis could throw a knife from an impossible distance and kill a man. So maybe they worked their magic in this case with an arrow. This story immediately reveals the solution. No divine bow, but a murderer in the room with the victim. If a knife, which is intended for close use, can be thrown, then an arrow can be used to stab. Everyone except Father Brown makes the error of assuming that the arrow can only mean one thing. Our expectations about the arrow, like those of the characters in the story, point us in one direction. But Chesterton deflects the meaning away from those expectations. Mysteries, like irony, make great use of deflection. The arrow itself is stable. Arrows are arrows. The uses to which arrows can be put, and the meanings we attach to them, however, are not so stable. Well, the seatbelt billboard is an arrow. So are the deadly dinner, the failed Christ figure, Hemingway's rain, and Beckett's road. In each case, the sign carries with it a customary meaning, but that doesn't guarantee it will deliver that received meaning. The signifier is stable. The rain is neither ironic nor not ironic. It's simply rain. That simple rain, however, is placed in a context where its conventional associations are upended. The signified's meaning stands opposed to what we expect. Since one half of the sign is stable and the other is not, the sign itself becomes unstable. It may mean many things, but what it won't mean is the thing we came in expecting that it would. Still, that expected meaning keeps hanging around, and since we experience this phantom meaning as an echo at the same time as the newly created dominant meaning, all sorts of reverberations can be set off. It's kind of like the way jazz improvisation works. Jazz musicians don't just launch into random sound. Rather, the combo begins by laying out a melody, which is the basis for everything that will follow. Then, when the trumpeter or the pianist cuts loose, running through the chorus 2, 3, 15 times, each one a little different, we hear each of those improvisations, those changes, against our memory of the original melody. That memory is largely what makes the experience of the solo meaningful. This is where he started, and now this is where he's taken us. What irony chiefly involves, then, is a deflection from expectation. When Oscar Wilde has one character in The Importance of Being Earnest, 1895, say of another, recently widowed, that her hair has gone quite gold from grief, the statement works because our expectation is that stress turns people's hair white. Someone becoming blonde in widowhood suggests something else entirely, that perhaps her grief has not been so all-consuming as the pronouncement suggests on the surface. Wilde is the master of comic irony in both verbal and dramatic forms, and he succeeds because he pays attention to expectations. Verbal irony forms the basis for what we mean when we say irony. In ancient Greek comedy, there was a character called an iron, who seemed subservient, ignorant, weak, and he played off a pompous, arrogant, clueless figure called the Alazon. Northrop Frye describes the Alazon as the character who doesn't know that he doesn't know, and that's just about perfect. What happens, as you can tell, is that the Iron spends most of his time verbally ridiculing, humiliating, undercutting, and generally getting the best of the Alazon, who doesn't get it. But we do. Irony works because the audience understands something that eludes one or more of the characters. By the time we get to Wild, we can have verbal irony that needs no Alazon, but that uses an assumed innocence as the basis against which it plays. The irony with which we're dealing in this discussion, though, is chiefly structural and dramatic, rather than verbal. We know what should happen when we see a journey start, or when the novel cycles through the seasons and ends in spring, or when characters dine together. When what should happen doesn't, then we have Chesterton's Arrow. E.M. Forster only wrote a handful of books early in the 20th century. But two of them, A Passage to India and Howard's End, 1910, are among the truly great novels. The latter deals with a class system and issues of individual worth. One of its important characters is a working-class man, Leonard Bast, who is determined to improve himself. He reads books approved for the purpose, such as John Ruskin on art and culture. He goes to lectures and concerts, always struggling to better himself. His efforts do lead him to meet people of the higher classes, the bourgeois Schlegel sisters, and through them, the aristocratic Wilcox family. We might expect this pattern to hold true and to lead him up and out of his wretched existence. Instead, he ends up finding greater wretchedness and death where he had hoped for his soul's ascent. Henry Wilcox advises him, through Helen Schlegel, to leave his banking position for a more secure firm. But the advice proves to be completely wrong, as his old bank continues to prosper while his new post is eliminated. Moreover, in his despair, he has spent a night with Helen that has left her pregnant, and when Charles Wilcox attempts to exact retribution, Leonard dies of a heart attack. Irony, right? But there's more. We would normally see his love of books as something that is affirming of values, improving and educational, all of which we know as positive virtues. As Leonard collapses, however, the last thing he sees are the books from the bookcase he has pulled over on himself. We sense the disjunction between what books ought to be and the function assigned to them here by Forster. It goes on and on. In Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, her damaged Great War veteran Septimus Warren Smith commits suicide because his enemies are coming to get him. His enemies? Two doctors. We customarily associate physicians with healing, but in this novel, they are interfering and threatening figures. Characters in Iris Murdoch's Unicorn spend a great deal of time trying to identify one of their number as the title creature, which is associated in folk mythology with Christ. Yet their first choice, who also seems to be the princess held captive in the tower, turns out to be selfish, manipulative, and murderous, while the second candidate winds up drowning another character, named Peter, no less. Hardly the image of Christ one would expect in either case. In each of these novels, the dislocation between our expectations and the reality constitutes a dual awareness, a kind of double hearing that is the hallmark of irony. That dual awareness can be tricky to achieve at times. I can bring a discussion of A Clockwork Orange to silence by suggesting that we consider Alex, its protagonist, as a Christ figure. Alex? The rapist and murderer Alex? No doubt Anthony Burgess's protagonist has some high negatives. He is supremely violent, arrogant, elitist, and worst of all, unrepentant. Moreover, his message is not one of love and universal brotherhood. If he's a Christ figure at all, it's not in any conventional sense. But let's consider a few facts. He leads a small band of followers, one of whom betrays him. He is succeeded by a man named Pete, although this fact is troubling since this Pete, unlike Peter, is also the betrayer. He is offered a bargain by the devil. He relinquishes his soul in the form of spiritual autonomy in exchange for the freedom awarded for undergoing aversion therapy. He wanders in the wilderness after his release from prison, then launches himself from a great height, one of the temptations Christ resists. He seems to be dead, but then revivifies. Finally, the story of his life carries a profound religious message. None of these attributes looks right. They look instead like parodies of Christ's attributes, or rather, none of the attributes but that last one. This is a very tricky business. No, Alex is not like Jesus. Nor is Burgess using Alex to denigrate or mock Jesus. It can look that way, however, if we approach the matter from the wrong angle or consider it carelessly. It's a help, of course, to know that Burgess himself held deep Christian convictions, that issues of goodness and spiritual healing occupy a major place in his thought and work. More important, though, is the item I place at the end of my list, that the purpose of telling Alex's story is to convey a message of religious and spiritual profundity. The book is really Burgess's entry in the very old debate over the problem of evil, namely, why would a benevolent deity permit evil to exist in his creation? His argument runs like this: there is no goodness without free will, without the ability to freely choose or reject the good. An individual possesses no control over his own soul, and without that control, there is no possibility of attaining grace. In the language of Christianity, a believer cannot be saved unless the choice to follow Christ is freely made, unless the option not to follow him genuinely exists. Compelled belief is no belief at all. The Gospels offer us a positive model for their argument. Jesus is the embodiment of the behaviors Christian believers should embrace, as well as the spiritual goal toward which they strive. A Clockwork Orange, on the other hand, provides a negative model. In other words, Burgess reminds us that for goodness to mean anything, not only must evil exist, but so must the option of choosing evil. Alex freely and joyously chooses evil, although in the final chapter he has begun to outgrow that choice. When his capacity to choose is taken away, evil is replaced not with goodness, but with a hollow simulacrum of goodness. Because he still wants to choose evil, he is in no way reformed. In acquiring the desired behavior through the Ludovico technique, as the aversion therapy is called in the novel, society has not only failed to correct Alex, but has committed a far worse crime against him by taking away his free will, which, for Burgess, is the hallmark of the human being. In this regard, and only in this one, is Alex a modern version of Christ. Those other aspects are a bit of ironic window dressing the author embeds in his text as cues for how to understand Alex's story and the message he unwittingly conveys. Nearly all writers employ irony sometimes, although the frequency of occurrence varies greatly. With some writers, particularly modern and postmodern writers, irony is a full-time business, so that as we read them more and more, we come to expect that they will inevitably thwart conventional expectations. Franz Kafka, Samuel Beckett, James Joyce, Vladimir Nabokov, Angela Carter, and T. Corrigeson Boyle are only a few of those 20th century masters of the ironic stance. If we were wise, we would never open a Boyle novel or short story expecting him to do the conventional thing. Some readers find relentless irony difficult to warm to, and some writers find that being ironic carries perils. Salman Rushdie's irony in the Satanic Verses did not register with certain Muslim clerics. So there's our second ironic precept. Irony doesn't work for everyone. Because of the multivocal nature of irony, we hear those multiple voices simultaneously, readers who are inclined toward univocal utterances simply may not register that multiplicity. For those who do, though, there are great compensations. Irony, sometimes comic, sometimes tragic, sometimes wry or perplexing, provides additional richness to the literary dish. And it certainly keeps us readers on our toes, inviting us, compelling us, to dig through layers of possible meaning and competing signification. We must remember, irony trumps everything. In other words, every chapter in this book goes out the window when irony comes in the door. How do you know if it's irony? Listen.